1323-59-CR, Amado Martinez Jr., also known as Amado Martinez versus the state of Texas.
And may it please this court, I am grateful for the opportunity to give the oral argument, and I do appreciate you allowing me to do so.
You're welcome.
I'm going to take each of my 3 points as they were laid out in the brief and make reference to them in that order. And the first one deals with the venue issue. The members of the U.S. Supreme Court case have famously said, we're all textualists now. And that has been the emphasis on where we're going. And I would urge that if we're textualists in this instance, it's going to be in interpreting 31.03 and 31.04, which are the sections that lay out what must be done in order to preserve a venue motion and that must be done to counter a venue motion. And the plaintiffs, Mr. Robles is the defense lawyer's presentation requesting the venue hearing, gave the affidavits. And I don't believe that there was any question before proceeding that his affidavits were adequate to raise the issue under 3104. And that section is in the Code of Criminal Procedure is very precise. It tells you exactly what you have to put in it, and he did exactly that. Then the response in 3104 is that the credibility of persons making the affidavit for change of venue or means of knowledge may be attacked by the affidavit of a credible person. In this case, the state didn't file an affidavit.
And Mr. Stapleton, this court did not allow the state to respond. How do we factor that into it?
Well, I think that's the judge's error. I mean, I sympathize with them. I think he did make a mistake, but it's still an error in his proceeding with the venue.
Well, in this case, as you know, the state is arguing that by cross-examination, they raised fact issues. So my question for you is, since the trial court did not allow the state to file a response and some controverting affidavits, what else could they have done beyond what they did?
Well, I don't think there was anything they could have done. I think it was inadequate. But I think the mistake was made by the trial judge as far as that goes. I mean, I would urge that the authority relied on by the state on appeal that says, well, all we have to do is cross-examine, give adequate evidence, is not adequate, and that it does not meet the text of the section. And I think that there is a reference in the Duro case as to affidavits or other evidence, but that reference came out on appeal when the appellant was complaining they didn't give us either affidavits or other evidence. That's where that language came from. It's not to be relied on in order to say, well, that's going to be adequate. And in the Duro case, they reversed it. It's a capital murder case. They reversed and said, no, you've got to give them a venue hearing. And so I've tried enough cases that I was sympathetic with the prosecutor in that case as far as him not being able to do anything with it. But I do think it was that the trial judge's error in doing that. I'd also say, as I pointed out in the reply brief, he really didn't impeach those witnesses. I mean,
he did not?
I don't think so. I don't think anything. He asked questions, but it mainly dealt with the size of the population of Cameron County and the size of the population of St. Joe.
So then your argument is that they did not controvert
your
evidence through their cross-examination.
That's my argument, that that they really didn't raise the issue. And then what the rule says in particular is that the issue thus formed, and it means after the affidavit, shall be tried by the judge. And so I would urge that his decision to go forward over the objection of the prosecutor was error, but it was not, but it was error harmful to Mr. Martinez, and that it should not be allowed, that we should go back to what the original language of the rule was. And there, we've cited in the briefs plenty of older law. I think from 78 was Duro, and then before that there was older law. And in every case where they reviewed it, even if there was a trial, they went ahead and said, well, no, prosecution has not filed affidavits, therefore we're not going to go forward. Now, I don't think we get anything but a new trial in that instance.
That was going to be my question. Is the remedy that you're seeking here would be a remand for a new trial?
It would on that point of error, Your Honor, okay. Because I think they then can do their affidavit properly, and then the judge can go forward with it. But the issue, and I know everybody's concerned about judicial economy as far as requiring a retrial, even especially if we have no idea the results are going to be the same or worse for Mr. Martinez. But the trial judges just don't have much guidance if we don't tell them from time to time, no, that's not adequate. And I will tell you that this is outside of the record, but I'm going to tell you this as long as you bear with me. Some of the judges now, trial judges, are saying, well, we don't, I'm not even going to consider a venue until after I see if we can pick a jury first.
We've had that issue come before us, actually.
Right. And I would urge that what we've basically done is gotten rid of venue law by that. I mean, between
unfortunately, not the case law out there, as I recall, if I recall correctly, supports that. Because I remember the case that we had, I think.
Well, I think I still am disputing it at a certain level.
Understandably.
So it may so far, but I'm not sure where we wind up. But at any rate, yes, I would urge that we should get a new trial on that particular issue. Let me touch on the next issue, and that is impeachment again on the Violence Against Women Act. And I think that the trial judge heard the trial lawyer trying to say, well, we want to ask this lady about her citizenship. And I think he had alarm bells go on and say, well, no, this is just prejudice, it's an appeal to bias and prejudice and that type of thing. As I pointed out in the briefing on the reply brief, the Violence Against Women Act gives great benefit to the person who testifies. Whether or not that was the intended consequences, she can avoid deportation.
Your argument is she would have reason to lie or exaggerate?
Yes.
The violence that was alleged in this case?
Yes, and or make it up in the first place. And we put in there a Fifth Circuit decision that describes how it was in a civil case, but how the Violence Against Women Act can be used. Fifth Circuit says, yeah, you've got to be able to impeach on that. Now, the state says, well, that is not the judge's error, that's prosecution error, and you can file a grievance or sue us or something like that. But the point is if the judge does not give us that kind of discovery, they say, well, you can find it independently. And you can file a Freedom of Information Act to get an A file for an immigration case, but I think most of the Violence Against Women Act activities occur with the benefit, with the advocate for the victim in the district attorney's office. They assist in preparing papers and all that sort of thing. So it would have been stuff that if they had asked their colleagues within the office, they would have been able to get it, but the defense could not have gotten it. And so I think that to say.
So you're saying that they fail to, within the own the office of the district attorney,
correct,
inquire as to whether this filing, yeah, had occurred, not other law enforcement agencies.
That's correct. I think they had an obligation with other law enforcement, but I think the information, if it there had been a filing, was there within there. And if she was eligible for filing, it may have been available through the INS immigration file.
But if she had, then there wouldn't be anything for them to produce, which of course they're not obligated, unless they have something, then they're obligated to give that to you. Right?
Isn't, yes,
the argument they're making here that they didn't have anything.
Well, those guys didn't, but to say, I don't know what's going on in the rest of my office, and I would submit that they do, under Brady, they do have an obligation to go through law enforcement and find out what's available. I mean, they're tasked.
To other agencies?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, their task under Brady to find out what's out there. And the defense lawyer had made requests early on and continued to make requests that were not responded to.
But they've argued, the state has argued that you questioned the complaining witness about her citizenship and whether she had applied under the Violence Against Women Act. So what is the harm here if you were able to question?
I don't believe the judge allowed an answer.
Oh.
That's my recollection, and I got it from the record also, but I don't think that I wasn't present for that
trial. That was subject to objection, okay.
Yeah, but I kind of have, knowing the personalities of the two people involved, I have a vision in mind of what was going on, and there was not going to be a lot of chit-chat back and forth, giving reasons, that sort of thing. Let me touch on the last issue. Judge signs an order dismissing the case, puts the order in there of the number that he eventually submits the jury instructions on. State says, well, that was just a clerical mistake. But every reference we have to clerical mistakes, we have some information from the trial judge on what was happening. We don't in this case. And so it's his intention, you know, I suspect they're probably right that he intended.
Well, because it says counts 2 and 3 at the top.
Right.
But then it says count 1 in the little blank.
And what they tell us is that's the only only writing in his hand. And so I accept that. And so, yeah, it says 1 and 2, but puts 1 in the blank, and that's the one he signs for the dismissal. Maybe it was just a mistake, but I would urge that we need some evidence of that. And the cases they give on mistakes with a pile of paper, they all went through hearings and that sort of thing, and we don't have that in this case.
Okay. So is that something that we could abate and remand to the trial court for clarification?
I'm afraid you could.
But that's not what you're asking.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
May it please the court.
Yes, good morning.
Thank you to the court for allowing me the privilege and honor of presenting oral arguments. To touch on appellant's first point of error, it's regarding the motion to change venue. As the court previously noted, the appellant's motion to change venue was filed on a Friday before a Monday trial, on a Friday at 4:30 p.m. And the record reflects that the prosecutor that tried the case did not discover this motion until late Sunday and then brought it up on the Monday morning of the trial and asked for a continuance to be able to file controverting affidavits, and the state saying it was unfair, the appellant's motion to change venue was untimely in violation of 28.01 of the Code of Criminal Procedure. As we all know, pretrial motions are supposed to be filed 7 days prior to trial. The indictment had been pending for almost a year at that point, and that motion had not been filed. It was filed less than 3 days before the trial was to begin. It was also in violation as to timeliness of the Cameron County local rules. So the state shows up Monday morning, surprised by this motion to change venue. Of course, has not filed any controverting affidavits, as there was no time to scramble at that point, and it wasn't done. Asked for more time and was denied. Now, normally, it is correct that when a motion for change of venue by the defense, in this case the appellant, goes uncontroverted by the state, appellant would normally be entitled to change of venue as a matter of law. However, here, and appellant did not address this in their argument or in their brief or reply brief, and to me, in my view, the real issue is the waiver of that right to grant the change of venue because of no controverting affidavits as a matter of law. That my argument is that that argument was, that right as a matter of law was waived by appellant when they proceeded to a full-blown evidentiary hearing on the issue. To quote Turner v. State, a defendant who permits the trial court to hear testimony on a motion for change of venue concedes that a fact issue is drawn and therefore waives his entitlement as a matter of law as to a change of venue.
Was there an objection lodged as to proceeding with the hearing?
No, in fact, a careful review of the reporter's record indicates that defense counsel, the trial counsel for appellant, willingly and voluntarily engaged in that hearing. In fact, in his own motion for change of venue, he asks for an evidentiary hearing, and then that morning of, he brings it up and tells the court that he wants a hearing on this motion. But he voluntarily waived his right as a matter of law to have that motion to change venue granted. Now, I concede that if appellant's trial counsel had not said anything, he would have been entitled to it to be granted, even setting aside the timeliness issue. But that didn't happen. He waived that right as a matter of law. So they proceeded to a full-blown evidentiary hearing, and at that point, the burden is on the appellant. The burden is on the appellant once it proceeds, who's asking for the change of venue. He has the burden of showing that the publicity produced has so much prejudice in the community that the likelihood of obtaining a fair and impartial jury is doubtful. Now, the trial court's reasons for denying the change of venue, the record makes clear that those reasons were not spelled out. Defense counsel at trial did not ask for findings or conclusions of law. They didn't ask on the record for the court to specify exactly why it was denied. In fact, the reporter's record indicates that there was a conference in chambers with all the attorneys and the judge, and it was denied. So really, it can be presumed that the reasons or the judge just wasn't convinced that they did not meet their burden.
What was the evidence at the hearing? I'll confess I have not had a chance to actually look at the record. Did they proceed with the affidavits or were witnesses called?
Yeah, correct, Your Honor. They proceeded actually with actual testimony. The affiants from the affidavits testified. Okay. One of them was the sister of appellant and the other one was a close friend. And they didn't provide, you know, they kept saying that there was a lot of social media publicity, that this would result in some sort of, you know, unfair prejudice. It was so great and immense and widespread that he couldn't get a fair and impartial trial.
So my question for you, though, the same question I had for Mr. Stapleton, is cross-examination by the state sufficient to controvert? I mean, it sounds like you needed to put on controverting evidence, not just cross-examination.
Correct, Your Honor. Really under Stanley v. State, 664 Southwest 2nd 746, and to quote, in a hearing on a defendant's motion for change of venue, the Cross-examination can undermine the defense's presentation so as to call into play the trial court's discretionary powers. An exercise of such discretionary powers is not precluded by the state's failure to present its own witnesses. So the law doesn't require...
Is that case cited in your brief? If not, can you give me the cite again?
The cite is... It was not, Your Honor. I did not prepare the appellant's brief, and this case was not known to me at the time, but the cite is 664 Southwest 2nd 746. It's out of the 4th Court of Appeals.
Okay.
And so that case makes clear that once we go to a full-blown evidentiary hearing, the state is not required to bring witnesses, and in fact, it specifically states that proper cross-examination can undermine the defense's presentation.
Is that also something that you did cite the Lundstrom case?
Correct.
Does that stand for that proposition, or was that more of a quote from the dicta language in the opinion?
The Lundstrom case, I believe, was cited for the proposition that the general proposition that appellant waived his right as a matter of law to have the motion to change venue granted.
So your contention is at that point in time, it becomes a fact issue for the court.
Exactly. At that point, it becomes a fact issue for the court. And of course, the burden on the motion is on the appellant. And it's implied through its ruling that the trial court was simply not convinced that there was such widespread media. In fact, the defense counsel at trial did not present screenshots of, you know, thousands of comments on Facebook or what have you that would indicate, oh, clearly all of these people know about this and there's no way they can get a fair trial. And they also didn't distinguish regarding the coverage. They indicated there was a lot of coverage, but the appellant's trial counsel did not distinguish the nature of the coverage. As everyone knows, the fact that there is widespread coverage, even if there is widespread coverage, there needs to be proof that it's false. If news agencies and newspaper articles cover a certain case and everything in the case is truthful in the coverage as relayed by the media, there is no presumption that any widespread coverage, even if it exists, harms and avoids the trial court from paneling a jury. And also, this motion for change of venue was brought up by appellant's trial counsel prior to voir dire. So I know earlier Mr. Stapleton mentioned that these venue laws were being circumvented by basically saying, well, let's do jury selection first, and then we'll hear the motion. And then if there is a jury, everyone just denies it. But that didn't happen in this case.
No, what they're doing is they're hearing the motion, but then they're holding off on ruling until afterward.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
That's not what happened here.
No.
What I'm saying. Yeah.
No. And of course, the law allows the appellant to, he could have re-urged it or raised it, even though it had been denied after. But a careful review of the court reporter's record regarding jury selection indicates very minimal questioning regarding publicity and any unfair prejudice and impartiality or lack of impartiality that may exist in the public. A very small percentage of the jury selection from appellant's trial counsel was spent on even that issue. Yet they were urging that just minutes prior, claiming that that was the case. But suddenly they didn't bring it up at all. Very, very minimal. So if the court has no further questions as to point of error number one, I'd like to move on to number two. Appellant's brief complains about the failure of the trial court to require the state to provide this so-called impeachment information regarding the victim's immigration status. Specifically, paperwork and responsive documents regarding the Violence Against Women Act. Now, as we all know, the Violence Against Women Act is a federal law. I believe it's been in place since the 90s, signed by President Clinton. And my response to this point of error is that it's no error at all, because the trial court wisely did not order the state of Texas to tender such documents, because the state of Texas is not and was not and still is not in possession of any responsive documents. The Violence Against Women Act, as we all know, is a federal law administered by a federal agency. Now, at the time that the trial court refused to order the state to provide it, the state of Texas, through its prosecutor, explicitly stated in the record, all we have regarding this information, regarding anything about our immigration status, we have no documents. All we have is the victim's statement saying that I'm a resident, and that's it. Now, at one point, appellant's trial counsel, when he was shut down by the court, he implied that he was going to make an offer of proof to properly preserve the issue. And I reviewed the transcript, and that never happened. He never did that. I don't know if he forgot or if he waived it, but it wasn't preserved. Appellant didn't preserve that error, if there even was error. But even if there was, there can't be error in this case because these documents are not in our possession. They weren't in our possession then. They're not in our possession now. And I'm not aware that they exist. In fact, the appellant and the state of Texas are on equal footing with regard to access to these records. Either side could have requested them from the federal government. And I can tell the court that the District Attorney's Office of Cameron County does not have and did not have responsive documents to the defense's request. Now, I understand this notion that a victim could be motivated to exaggerate or lie if they feel that they can get immigration status in this country. And I'm not disputing that general principle. I am disputing the appellant's request that they're asking us to produce documents that I am not even aware exist. In fact, appellant has shown no evidence that exists. Defense's trial counsel never filed a subpoena for said requests. And as far as the record shows, there was no attempts of any kind to request these. If I don't know if an email or phone call was made, but that's not in the record, so there's no evidence of that at all.
So appellant has cited to, is it Giglio or Giglio, G-I-G-L-I-O versus U.S., saying that individual prosecutors has a duty to learn of any favorable evidence known to the others acting on the government's behalf, including the police, citing to Kyles v. Whitney. How far does your duty go to get this kind of information?
My duty as a prosecutor for the state of Texas, it extends to my understanding of the law. It extends to the police departments, the constables, the sheriff's office. Some cases in the Court of Appeals and Court of Criminal Appeals have even said that it extends to other DA's offices. So, for instance, Hidalgo County DA's office had some of this impeachment material, and then Cameron County didn't have it. Even if we weren't aware of it, then that could fall on us. However, there's no evidence that they have any of that. There's no reason for us to believe that they would. Really, the distinction here is that the material that the appellant is requesting is held by the federal government, which falls outside that umbrella. And I agree, if some other police station had it and they just didn't tell us, even though it wasn't our fault, then it would fall on us. But that's not the case here. It's because we're on equal footing, appellant and state of Texas, with regards to the federal government. They're not under our control. They're not our agents. And there's really nothing we could do that they couldn't do either. And for some unknown reason, appellant's trial counsel failed to request it. And it's certainly not in the record that they even requested. And then they did not make an offer of proof. They didn't go further. And this jury even heard the question. So even if he should have been allowed to ask it, in my opinion, that was already put before the jury by the mere asking the question, oh, are you legal in this country? Are you illegal? That clearly puts it into their minds anyway. So even to me, it was already brought up anyway in front of the jury, even though they didn't answer the question. Regarding appellant's point of error 3, this dismissal of count 1, in my view, this dismissal, I think we all see on the exhibit that the dismissal that's submitted by the state of Texas says dismissal of counts 2 and 3, which did not go to trial. A careful review of the reporter's record indicates that the state and the trial court and the defense had a brief conference, and the state informed the court that they're dismissing counts 2 and 3, which was counts 2 was a burglary of a habitation, count 3 was attempted murder, and that they're proceeding only on count 1, which is the aggravated assault. In fact, the state's motion to dismiss, which is titled Motion to Dismiss Counts 2 and 3, a few lines below that further explains in detail that the state is proceeding on count 1, which is on the record. Now, on the attached order to said motion to dismiss, the order on the same page at the bottom is titled Motion to Dismiss Counts 2 and 3. Now, it's not to the very bottom that there's another blank, and somebody, presumably the judge, obviously the appellant disagrees with this, but somebody wrote in one, count one, which is contrary to the oral pronouncements made at the hearing on the reporter's record. Now,
at what point was this signed, though? Was it signed before the trial?
I think it was signed. I think the date stamp makes clear it was signed before the verdict was read.
Okay.
Yes. So at some point before the verdict was entered and read, before the guilty verdict was entered.
But not necessarily before the trial.
Correct.
I ask that because, I mean, if it had been signed before the trial, then it seems it might have been incumbent on defense counsel to object to proceeding to trial on count one if, in fact, it was being dismissed.
Because how could you proceed on a dismissed count? It doesn't seem to make sense. However, also keeping in mind Code of Criminal Procedure 32.02, the general principle that a trial court does not have authority to dismiss a case unless the prosecutor requests its dismissal. So the record is clear that the state of Texas never requested count one to be dismissed. In fact, on the record, the court and the prosecutor discussed how they're only going to trial on court one, on count one. And during the formal arraignment in front of the jury, he was arraigned only on count one. He entered a plea of not guilty only on count one and was convicted by the jury only on count one. That's the only count that went to trial. So even if the motion was signed, which it clearly was, and the judge wrote in one, which I feel he did by accident, that motion to dismiss is void because the judge had no authority to dismiss count one. And so it has no effect because it contradicts the oral pronouncement with this mistaken written order. And as we all know, when there's a difference between a judge's oral pronouncement and a written order, the oral pronouncement controls. And so I think what needs to happen in this case would be for the court to either just reform that or change the judgment, make it clear, or send it back down to the trial court for them to correct their own order, which it's clearly mistaken because it conflicts with the written order and the oral pronouncement. And so to me, it's very clear it's a mistake due to that conflict between the oral pronouncement and the written order.
Okay.
That's all I have. Thank you.
More questions? All right. No. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Stapleton, if you don't mind, could you address the waiver issue?
Yeah, waiver. Generally, if you file for a non-jury hearing prior to trial, for instance, in Rule 103, then you do not have to raise it again. And the trial lawyer had a ruling on this matter. It's in front of the judge, and it's not, I would urge that he had his ruling. And I don't really trust the way the rule says and still make objections during trial, but we're supposed to be entitled to get a pretrial ruling that we do not have to raise again. And so I would say he could not raise it. And we run into this problem. The judge says, all right, we're going to go forward on this hearing. So he's already objected, same judge, same issue. Then do we require him at each step to make another objection? I just don't think that that's what Rule 103 dealing with prior objections refers to.
Thank you.
That would be my response. Let me touch on just a couple of other things. And I'm not familiar with the Stanley case, but it's a Southwest second decision. And it's a Fourth Court of Appeals. My hunch is it probably predates Lundstrom. But in any case, I have put in the reply brief the language out of the section and urge that there just is no controversion of those affidavits in any cross-examination. It wouldn't rise to that level, and it is contrary to the rule. The rule says that they have to file affidavits.
Again, following up the question I asked you before, obviously they were prohibited from doing so. Could they have called a live person?
At the hearing on, mm-hmm. Yeah, and they did. They didn't call any live people, but I think that had they called them, they would have had a better chance of saying, well, we controverted the affidavit.
That's my question, yeah.
Yeah, I think so. But I would still be urging, we've got to have some clear rules. We flounder without guidance. And the guidance I would urge is that the rule says we get affidavits, state has to give affidavits, and then the issue is heard. And prior to that, we're just not there. I think the judge should have given him some time. I agree. Now, the judge did not strike his motion in this case, and we heard no argument at trial that, well, he was filed too late, it's against local rules, that sort of thing. The judge may have said, no, I'm just not going to accept this filing and stricken it, and then we would have had to deal with a different argument. But, you know, that's not what happened here either. Let me finally touch on, counsel bravely talked about the scope of his duty and what was in his office. I hope he's not disproved on that in some written in the future, though in truth the sanctions are minimal. But I almost jumped up and advised him to plead the fifth in that very moment. I would urge that the scope of the duty is not barred by what that person can get in his mind. And the trial judge seemed to think so. And, you know, do you know? No, I don't know. Okay.
But the argument is that the information is with a federal agency and it doesn't go that far. Do you agree with that?
No, I don't. I think that under Giglio and under Brady, that they have to make inquiry, and that in practice there's interagency cooperation all the time. And I would say beyond that, that it's that rule is not applied at the federal level, it's applied at the state level. Their office does it, and so we should have information.
The processing of the applications?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. The case will be under submission. Y'all have a